Up next, from Supernova 2006, Eric Shapiro from AT&T tackles some tough questions from the audience. You may not agree with his answers, but he gets points for addressing them all on IT Conversations. Hi, and welcome to IT Conversations. I'm Phil Windley, the executive producer. Today, I'm excited to bring you a presentation from Supernova 2006, held in San Francisco, California, June 21st to 23rd.
If you'll be attending the Podcast and Portable Media Expo at the end of September, and we hope you will, why not come by one day early on September 28th and attend a special one-day podcast academy crammed full of sessions for the professional podcaster. We've even got a half day of classes by instructors on the leading edge of video. There are just a few seats left, so hurry over to podcastacademy.com. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at limelightnetworks.com.
And now here's our presentation from Supernova.
All right, so one more thing before lunch. We're going to bring up Eric Shapiro from AT&T. As some of you may know, I used to work at the FCC, so communications industry is one of great interest to me, and I think sort of typifies this theme we have for this year of making connections in a complex world. Communications, of course, is about connectivity by its very nature. It's also about as complex a world as you can imagine, and AT&T is a perfect example of that. AT&T is sponsoring the conference again this year, which we're very happy about, but it's a different company than it was a year ago. It's a company as a result of a merger between the former AT&T and SBC. That's changed internally, but it's also a different company because the industry that it's in is changing very radically and very dramatically, thanks to things like convergence and other changes going on. So I think the perspective that they have on these issues of change and innovation is extremely relevant more broadly than that industry, and so that's a reason that I wanted to have them here. Eric, who's here, is the VP of Business Development at AT&T, so he's got the task, and I'll come around so you don't have to look back at me here, so yeah, take your pick. You get the unenviable task of charting strategy in this complex world. So let me ask you, I mean, the good thing about your company is, you know, 100 or so years old, you know, lots and lots of employees, millions and millions of customers, you know, huge, long history, and that's also the bad thing. So, you know, how do you take advantage of the good without, you know, getting dragged down by the legacy and being too slow moving?
So, I mean, clearly, as we just heard from the last panel, I mean, we've had to transform and we've had to innovate within our business. I mean, way back to the late 90s, I actually think it was the late 90s where folks were predicting the death of the telcos, as we were affectionately called back then, because of the internet. And I'm happy to say by sitting here that the new AT&T is doing extremely well. But with that said, I mean, clearly the industry did go through dramatic changes, as you said. I mean, we had a lot of new entrants and competition and voice services and other services, both at the consumer and the business side. We had consolidation, as you alluded to, clearly new technologies. So the industry transformed and we had to make decisions back in, you know, the late 90s, both the legacy AT&T as well as SBC. And so, just like I heard in the previous panel, I mean, we went out and we talked to our customers, our consumers, our business customers, you know, and this was before blogs and wikis, and, you know, what were they looking for? What were they expecting? And the one thing that was consistent, and I guess good for us, is that the network was going to be the enabler of all of these services. So whether on the consumer side, for digital lifestyle and mobility, capabilities, you know, clearly you need the network for collaboration and all those services that ride over the network. You know, clearly on the business side, our customers were going global. Even in the late 90s, they were already offshoring, they were already transforming their business processes, and they needed the network as they were going through that transformation and the cost cutting to have the network enable them to do that collaboration communication worldwide. So we had to make some choices. And, you know, the good news is, as you think about the legacy companies, but the new AT&T, we had a lot of great capabilities that you just mentioned. I mean, combined, we hold 6,000 patents that we're now, you know, we've gone through over the last many years and enabled them. So building out a global IP MPLS network, you know, one of the largest in the world. We started there and we're doing IP before anyone else was doing IP. We were doing voice over IP back in the late 90s. You know, launching collaboration type services bundles to the consumers, you know, which SBC was excellent at, and now as a combined company, we've done that. You know, probably one of the biggest transformations that we made was really transforming also the network into a software-based infrastructure network. You know, we could have reinvented, you know, the legacy TDM and circuit switch network and those boat anchor switches and whatnot, but you know, we had to open up our network to make it much more software-defined. So as we just heard, we could launch new services much more quickly to meet our customers' needs. We had to build APIs so customers and developers could build new applications on the network. We had to be able to provide these new services and capabilities. So, you know, we leveraged not only our core competency, those patents I mentioned, the intellectual capital we have with AT&T Labs, but we also an ecosystem of partners. I mean, I think as you'll look, a lot of our new services, our core capabilities we're launching on the consumer side, like IPTV, UVerse, on the business side, our managed RFID services, those are driven with partner ecosystems, small companies, mid-sized companies, that are really helping us launch and meet our consumer business requirements.
So if the network is the center of all this, where's the line between the network that you provide and services that you provide around the network or your partners provide around the network and the network that you offer and then other people do things with it that you don't know about or care about or have anything to do with?
Well, so I think, you know, once again, the dynamics continue to change. But as you think about, you know, we've built out this global IPMPLS network capability. And then on top of it, we've layered on this service-oriented architecture, service delivery platform. We've leveraged, you know, best-in-class capabilities like Microsoft's Connected Services Framework. And so to let developers, let others, you know, access the network, develop onto the network. So if you want that next collaboration capability, you know, it's a much more open architected environment. You know, we're even, I think as Kim was just talking about, you know, looking at open source capabilities. There's open source routers, open source PPXs. But, you know, it's all about the services. You know, what can we do collaboratively to bring new services to both our businesses and consumers? You know, it's all about the user experience and the user interface. And clearly, the end-to-end the network is the enabler.
Mm-hmm. Although, I guess what I was asking is there, I mean, there are services you provide, and there are services that get provided to consumers through your network, which aren't yours in any way. And, you know, and there sometimes can be a tension who's providing those services. So how do you draw that line when someone comes in and says, well, no, I mean, yeah, you could do that, but I want to do that?
Well, you know, that's always a difficult, you know, task in terms of building any ecosystem of partners. I mean, clearly, from a broadband access and what we do from the 7+ million DSL lines, clearly, you know, our global MPLS infrastructure, clearly our 30 data centers. I mean, that's our core. Those are our core capabilities. Our managed services, whether they be on the consumer side, our UVerse capability, I mean, you know, that's our service. And on the business side, our other managed services. But with inside, so if you think about in our Lightspeed, our UVerse IPTV offer, the set-top box, the residential gateway, I mean, those are key components of the ecosystem, working with the folks like Two Wire, working with the, you know, the Scientific Atlantas, working with the Microsofts that have core components within that infrastructure. And really, at the end, it's delivering that service to the end customer. So clearly, we believe we own the network, we own the network infrastructure, you know, the ability to provide that content to consumer and businesses across those capabilities.
But then how do you compete against companies like Skype that revel in the fact that they don't have all that stuff and they don't have all the costs that come along with it and they just ride on top of the network because, you know, VoIP, voice over IP, allows you to disintermediate the network from the communications process?
Well, I anticipated the question about Skype, and I'm surprised you didn't throw Vonage in there as well. I mean, I think there are a couple things. One of the things that we continually find with our customers is they're not looking just for singular solutions. So they're not just looking for voice over IP. So on the consumer space, they want, you know, broadband access, they want voice over IP, they want IPTV, they want a bundle, they want wireless and mobility, and of course with our singular assets, you know, we can combine that and compete, you know, very effectively. And in addition, you know, security. I mean, one of our strongest assets is what AT&T has done, both on business side and consumer side, around security. And you know, a lot of our business customers were very interested in Skype, obviously from a cost perspective, some of the other, you know, interesting things about it. But when it gets down to thinking about all the attacks we've had, worms, viruses, DDoS attacks, you know, is an enterprise willing to open up their environment with Skype or someone else just because of the cost or the price perspective? So, you know, we go out, and I spend a lot of time with CIOs on the business side. You know, security is top of mind. That's number one. And, you know, we have built an anomaly detection capability to actually see what's happening in the cloud across the network before these worms, viruses, and attacks are going to happen and protect our customers' environment. And I got to tell you, that is number one on their mind. And I think also on the consumer side, you know, there's concerns there as well. So, you know, I think we compete effectively, more than effectively, with those guys, both from a capability, bundle, security. And then, you know, the last thing I would say is, you know, from a cost of acquisition, how sustainable are some of those businesses' models versus, you know, from an AT&T? Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, would you agree at a broader level that the price of basic voice connectivity is going to zero?
Well, I certainly hope it never goes to zero, but I mean...
asymptotically.
You know, right. I mean, clearly, you know, we have seen the price of voice come down. But once again, voice is one application on the network. So if I want to take voice and integrate it in with other collaborations, and I want to, you know, tie it in with, you know, other network-based services, Office Live Meeting and whatnot, it's no longer just voice. You know, it's a whole interactive communications experience, and then the feature functionality. Do I want location-based services? Do I want it integrated with presence-based services? So, you know, we're not stuck on focusing on voice as we're stuck on focusing on, you know, traditional voice. I mean, we could have reinvented long-distance voice, you know, back in the late 90s, right? It's really a different, so we've just heard about all the collaboration tools that this audience is working on, communication tools, and voice is a component, one application, and, you know, probably still the killer application at this point.
So this gets to this topic of network neutrality that's you know, very controversial on a lot of people's minds.
You think?
I don't know, do you think? That where people say, well, that's well and good, but, you know, that's not your job to do the collaboration stuff because you shouldn't be able to choose what people do on the network. You should just provide the network and let people do what they want. So, you know, how do you respond when people say, I'm really worried that, you know, this internet thing, which is so wonderful, is going away because companies like AT&T and other network providers want to change the model?
So the first thing I would say is I think the whole term network neutrality and the concept is well misunderstood. And let me say, from an AT&T perspective, we are not going to block anyone getting access to content or anyone providing legal content, you know, across the web. That is not, you know, what AT&T is going to do at all. What we have said is we have built and invested in this global IPLS backbone, our network, and for years we've been providing managed services to our business customers with class of service, quality of service, where they want premium delivery, priority of delivery of their content and their services. And so I can go in and prioritize, you know, voice over email or sometimes video or even a software-based application over another. So what we're saying in the consumer world, it's the same thing from a business offering managed IP services across our backbone of our network as well. And if a content provider chooses, and once again, that's the term chooses, that they want, you know, some type of premium delivery over our network or prioritization across our network, that's what we're talking about from that experience. We're not forcing anyone to do it from a content provider. You know, we're still thinking about what the potential offers would look like. But that's, you know, what we're talking about. So think about it, you know, almost from a overnight delivery. I mean, I can choose to get a package, you know, next day and pay a little more, or I can choose to get it a week later. But once again, it's within our network, within the managed IP environment that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Let me invite people to come up if they want to ask questions. I know this is a hot button, but also some of the other things you talked about I think are really important as well. And just let me just follow up though briefly on that, and, you know, why do you think then that there's such attention being given to this topic, and it's inflamed, you know, so many passions?
Well, I think part of it is the misunderstanding, right? So I think there is the misunderstanding, and we've all come to rely on the public internet. When people are thinking that we're talking about the public internet, it's incorrectly perceived. So I think part of it's the miscommunication, the misunderstanding. I think there's, you know, the view in terms of folks not realizing how much competition there is out there. I mean, obviously, we now compete with cable, they compete with us, we compete with systems integrators and others. So, you know, it's also understanding the dynamics of what has happened and changed in the industry landscape.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hi, I'm David Irwin from the Institute for Communications Law Studies. Like Kevin, I worked some number of years at the FCC. I was a mindless bureaucrat. During that period, it might be the legacy John DeButts, AT&T, where hell no, we're not going to interconnect, or okay, you know, over our dead bodies, the Court of Appeals is allowing inner-city long distance, but they're going to have a local access code and input a account code and a PIN, and then the 10 digits associated with calling a number. And if they're not the most dexterous people in the world, they got to do it all over again. And moreover, that's on the line side, not the circuit side. And AT&T's got one plus, and I don't know how many cases and how much precedent there is on undue, unjust, unreasonable discrimination.
Okay, so question.
Right. Is there a question?
What's changed?
Question.
I don't know enough yet. I don't know what to say about net neutrality. I'm not necessarily against it because I am a capitalist. But why should we trust AT&T now? Is it because of the SBC merger? I mean, Ed Whitaker is hardly the pinnacle of the R box in the competitive era. So why should we trust AT&T?
You know, if I understand your question correctly in terms of what's changed, what has not changed, and why should you trust AT&T? I mean, I think, you know, once again, from an AT&T perspective, we are looking to deliver quality services to end user customers. We think the environment, you know, there's plenty of competition. It's not just what changed at AT&T, but it's a very competitive landscape, a competitive market that you know. And what the folks here in this room are hoping to build is, you know, Web 2.0 and the next generation of services. We're part of that in terms of building those services. And, you know, we don't think that, you know, more government regulation around that is what's required. So I'd say, you know, AT&T has always been a trusted advisor to our customers, and that has not changed, and it's not changed for the 100 years that we've been in business.
Well, so this actually gets back to what we just talked about on that last panel about innovation, that you know, you've got, you're part of a very established organization, and it's one that's, you know, changed a lot in terms of its corporate structure and so forth. But I mean, how do you change, you know, the culture and change the reputation in this new world, which calls on different things than it took to be successful as the AT&T or the Bell companies of the previous era?
I think changing the culture, as we just heard, is, you know, one of the biggest opportunities and challenges that we went through. But we were forced. I mean, we had to innovate, right? As you mentioned, you know, as prices declined, we had to automate. We had to find new ways to deliver services. Consumers and businesses were looking for new capabilities and new services. You know, we had to automate. We had to deliver those new capabilities. So, you know, I think the way that we've innovated is, you know, put some focus. So, I mean, we said, okay, what are the key focus areas? Well, clearly wireless, right? So, you know, making a focused investment in wireless technologies with Singular, what we're doing around WiMAX and HSDPA, and what we'll do with 802.16e when it becomes approved. I mean, looking at things like sensor-based networks, which, you know, folks never thought of AT&T before, but you know what? It's a $50 billion market, RFID part of that, growing at 40% plus CAGRs. And you know what? It all, if you want to take it out of the local office or the local warehouse, it all has to go across a network. So we had to open our minds and think about what are those new capabilities, what are those new technologies, and what were we creating to meet our customers' requirements, both in our labs environment as well as that ecosystem I mentioned before. And, you know, so we, you know, for example, the business development organization, the new services part of it, and it's a relatively new organization. And so we made some structural and organizational changes to say, we need to get services out much more quickly. Our customers expect to have that new unified communication collaboration, you know, service, not in a year, but they expect it 90 to days to 6 months. And that goes back to the software-defined architecture. So, you know, once again, instilling within the organization, within the culture, you know, a rapid, customer-centric, competitive positioning. And I think we've been very successful. I mean, I think if you look at the results and how the new AT&T is performing in the market.
If I may, just a follow-on question, which refers back to something that Kevin talked about, and that is this asymptotic move of voice cost, particularly in IP world, approaching zero. I mean, for the cable companies, for you, it could be a giveaway if you don't, you know, package it. And I hear everything you're saying. As the law is now, there's a case styled as Trinco which basically makes the telephone industry regulated by the 96 Act immune from antitrust, Sherman Act, Clayton Act rigors. New world, okay? Congress is rewriting, or supposedly rewriting, who knows, not the Communications Act, but something. I mean, would AT&T, SBC, Verizon, you can't speak for them, be willing to get out of the business of having this antitrust umbrella of protection? So, okay, we're like anybody else. We're Firestone.
I'm not the right person to comment on our public policy positioning. I'm happy to hook you up with the right individual. My focus is, all around new capabilities, new technologies, new services that we can provide to the market and build those businesses. So, I apologize, but I'm just not the right person. I can introduce you.
Let me try and take it in a direction I think maybe relevant to what you can answer, which is, this is a regulated industry still, and regulation has changed, and it's lessened a lot, but that's still an overhang. So, how do you work within that confine in terms of thinking about innovation and being able to innovate, within that context?
I think once again, we are bound by certain regulation, and certainly within the organization, we have to adhere and respect, which we do, to that regulation. I don't think, though, that stops, you from innovating, or all of our industries have different types of regulation, whether it be the financial services industry and what they can do with IM and email and archiving. So I think it doesn't prohibit us from innovating. I think, once again, we have to think about how we collaborate internally, how we share information between the regulated and unregulated parts of the business, and adhere, and everybody understands. So we have done, we first brought SBC and AT&T together. I mean, everybody was educated on what those regulatory requirements were and, what we can collaborate and communicate on. But the innovation perspective, the innovation machine, developing new capabilities, developing new patents, that's a continuing ongoing process.
So we had these two sessions this morning on sort of more consumer focus, blog and wiki types of stuff, and then on enterprises and larger organizations. You're a company that has both of those, customer bases and, a large amount. I mean, is there a different way you think about those two markets in terms of the kinds of innovations you're talking about?
Well, I mean, I think to Kim's point, clearly at a certain extent you do see the consumer and the remote worker and even some of the small biz, small office, very comparable in terms of the services they expect, the collaboration type experience they expect, and, what we deliver from a mobility and a wireline capability. So there is a lot of synergy there, and as we think about those services, as we've developed them, they are very, synergistic. On the business side is where, and obviously we think about the new services and really the opportunities. So, all the CIOs thinking about the convergence of IP and IT, and how do I go out, as Jonathan, touched on a little bit this morning, and now take this global IP network and leverage AT&T's capabilities around public grid capability. Once again, that's not unique to AT&T operating 30 data centers for our customers, but something that's top of mind is re-engineering the data center, thinking about grid and virtualization type capabilities. The same thing on business customers, thinking about some of the new technologies we're looking at. So display over IP or the next generation of thin clients, and putting now all the applications, the OS, and everything in the cloud. So once again, the network's the enabler, and if you think about that, the impact on security, and we all see what's happening with stolen laptops and whatnot, but also lowering their cost for servicing those desktops and laptops. So there's a whole host of these new services. I mentioned sensor-based networks and RFID, things that traditionally maybe folks didn't think of AT&T, but once again, if you think about getting that information, mining that information, federating that information, securing that information, that's a core competency that we deliver to business customers every day, and I think we're the only service providers, and I think of some of those spaces that are doing it globally. So there's definitely synergies to a certain extent, but clearly the larger customers, business customers, there's some unique interests that they're looking for.
So, 5 years from now or so, what kind of company do you want to be, and who do you think you'll compete with, and what business do you want to be in?
Well, clearly, as we said, we aspire, You know, we are already the largest U.S. Networking provider. We aspire to be, you know, the global networking and entertainment provider. So once again, the network is our core competency, our core capabilities, but delivering the capabilities around IPTV and our UVerse Lightspeed offer, which, you know, will pass 19 million homes in 2008, providing other types of content. So you might have read about our Home Zone offer, which is bundling, you know, high-speed internet with satellite and then some of the content from some of the folks that we've announced. And so really, if you think about the various screens, the multiple screens, you know, we think AT&T providing those services, online gaming, which was spoken about earlier about, and we you know, provide the network for a lot of those online gaming companies and provide that content to the consumers. So I think it's, you know, the networking and entertainment companies who we aspire to be and who I think we're successfully operating from.
Okay, so final question. What's the biggest thing you worry about standing in the way, not just for you, but for the industry getting to where we all want it to go, and how do you think we'll overcome that?
I think that, you know, the biggest thing is, you know, if things are changing fast, you know, consumer are changing fast. I mean, I don't know, a lot of you probably, well, actually most of you look a lot younger than I am, but I have a, you know, 14-year-old son. And so what I think about, what keeps me awake, is I watch him and see how he is going to be that next generation employee. He's going to be off there and all the multitasking he does in terms of, you know, he's on his laptop, he's, you know, IMing, he's playing some multiplayer game on his VoIP connection, he's maybe doing his homework in another spreadsheet while on one of his screens he's watching ESPN. And I think it's
you just described half the people in this room, you realize.
Right. So. That's me too, right? So I'm like that, you know, that's kind of how I, you know, collaborate with my son. But he's the guy that's going to be, you know, coming into the workforce. So, you know, while we all operate to a certain extent, I mean, we have to think about what are those tools, you know, that we as businesses need to provide to those guys coming up. And so that's what I constantly think about, you know, for us as well as, you know, our children. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's a good way to end. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation delivered at Supernova, held in San Francisco, California, June 21st to 23rd, 2006.
If you'll be attending the Podcast and Portable Media Expo at the end of September, and we hope you will, why not come by one day early on September 28th and attend a special one-day podcast academy crammed full of sessions for the professional podcaster. We've even got a half day of classes by instructors on the leading edge of video. There are just a few seats left, so hurry over to podcastacademy.com. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at limelightnetworks.com. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Jeremy Glenn. Our website editor was Charlie Batho. The series producer is Charlie Batho.
This is Phil Wendley, and I look forward to bringing you more from Supernova here on IT Conversations.